Hello and welcome to another episode of the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at RadioReverb.com, on DAB, and of course on our podcast. I'm AD Packham and we are in your ears thanks to the brilliant oldfootballshirts.com. Well, it's still no wins for new boss Roberto De Zerbi, but at least there was some reasons to be cheerful, despite going down to the 12 men of champions Manchester City on Saturday. The performance saw some say that it was the best they'd seen at the Etihad this season, and perhaps, were it not for some psychedelic refereeing, we could have come away with something. So, now all eyes turn to Saturday, when we will see the return of Graham Potter, Mark Cucurella, and all the other members of staff nicked by Chelsea. Will Potter be greeted like a returning hero? Will the players be desperate to get one over on their former gaffer? Will Bruno be ignored? I guess all will be revealed on 3 o'clock on Saturday, I suppose. 3 o'clock on a Saturday is something that certainly isn't going to be happening come New Year's Eve, when we're going to be scratching our heads trying to get to New Year's Eve parties after the late kickoff on New Year's Eve against Arsenal. And also this week, the brilliant news that Alexis McAllister will still be with us up till 2025 after signing a new contract at the club. Joining me today is, of course, Alan Wares, and we are delighted to welcome back the Argus' chief sports correspondent, Brian Owen. How are you, Brian?
Yeah, not bad, thank you. Thanks, AD. Just waiting for this next win.
It's been a weird start to his Albion career, really, hasn't it?
It was an amazing first 15, 20 minutes. But yeah, it's just true. Getting a little bit... now it's starting to feel like almost we're saying the same things and asking the same questions and he's having to answer the same questions. The sort of run which did happen under the previous head coach as well. But is it all building towards one of the great afternoons at the Amex on Saturday, or is that too optimistic? We will wait and see.
Absolutely. I mean, well, there's certainly a lot of spice to it. And believe me, the sports media will make something of it because they can't not. But I mean, it's kind of interesting to consider if you really felt so inclined that given the fact that, you know, the transition between Potter and De Zerbi was relatively smooth in terms of on-pitch playing. You know, sort of the players clearly were all familiar with about 85%, 90% of De Zerbi's tactics. I mean, it's just, you know, wonder if it's worth contemplating the fact that the lack of shooting or the regression in the shooting quality, would that have happened whether Potter was here or whether it was just because it was under De Zerbi anyway? I mean, it is one of those sort of hypotheticals, one of the great imponderables. But, you know, we are still playing well. We've rarely played badly against any of the clubs that we've played against. And it's the shooting that's let us down. So I'm just wondering if it is, you know, would that have happened under Potter anyway? So I'll just throw that one out there.
Well, you look at the games coming up. Brighton were quite capable of not getting so many points in that run of fixtures. Yeah. Even Brentford away was it's a tricky game. But I don't want to harp on about it as such. But it doesn't do any good to think too much about this. But they were in such a good position to tackle whatever challenges would come. Probably the best position ever. And then it was sort of snatched from under their feet. That's not a criticism of people for leaving to join other clubs. It's just how it happened. Yeah. And just at that moment, you know, what might have been the peak moment, that might have been the best it ever got for Potter. We'll never know.
I mean, it was a landmark day, wasn't it, that Leicester game? I mean, should have.
First time we hit five in the top division.
Six. Oh, it was six. I'm still calling it six.
So in that case, we've still never hit five.
But what would have happened, though? What would have happened if that goal hadn't been disallowed, if that had stood? Would that game have then gone on? Would Brighton have then gone into another gear as they did or not? Sorry, it's a long time ago. It's history. But I always wonder, you know, whether they would have finished as big as well as they did. But you just look back at that and it's like, if you were doing a film of a head coach who comes from nowhere and takes over a club and has the trials and tribulations, and on the final scene, the number 10 puts a free kick into the top corner and the head coach turns around and looks up to the top tier in some distant...
You've been thinking about this, haven't you?
You've got a sideline as a screenwriter now, Brian.
If you'd have written that like a sort of a Moneyball-type film or a sporting-type film, It would have just been, oh yeah, so cliche. It doesn't happen like that in
Yeah.
real life.
But
Well,
who,
actually, it
so
did.
who was playing Graham Potter?
Paul
I'm not.
Weller. Yeah, I'm not sure, but it was it that's just how it worked out, wasn't it? We never knew, it just got to such a high point, and that's why it was so hard to take, because it took a long time to get there with some
Yeah.
winless runs and
Yeah.
goalless runs and what have you, and that's why it stung, and there will be a bit of bitterness within some people on Saturday, no
And
doubt.
of course, we had that 6-game losing streak under Potter last season as well, which and it was exactly.
This is the notion of the perspective, isn't it? I mean, we had gone from pretty much one of the lowest lows. I mean, I don't think there was particularly a clamour for people calling for Potter's head during that run. I think it is also, I mean, it wasn't just the fact that it was a six match losing streak. I mean, there was a couple of performances within that were probably amongst Potter's worst as well. And even the last of those non-wins was a dour nil-nil draw against Norwich, the likes of which was being compared to the Forest game of last week. And then, we just sort of everything just clicked. And, this is what happens. You play Arsenal away, everything clicks. And after that, we're top quality, in-form side. And like I say, it does peak at playing against Leicester. And you it's fair enough that he left us on that high, and you consider the what ifs. You can actually understand, therefore, the move. But again, there's so many what ifs that need to be, not need to be, that are being contemplated along the lines of could he have done better? Had he has got as high as he, yes, it was the highest he'd taken us, but could he have gone higher? And now we don't have that answer, and now we've got to ask that question of someone else. And at the moment, the bloke, to be fair, I think, is still getting his feet under the table. And let's face it, it's a bare minimum of 10 matches in a new league, in a new system, in a new culture. And by the time he's got through those 10 matches, he's got to stop again.
It's. I mean, this season, Brian, was always going to be weird with the World Cup anyway. But I mean, obviously, after that Leicester game, we had 2 games postponed as well. Don't forget with the Palace and the Bournemouth game going because of the Queen and the train strike slash the Queen. So I mean, obviously, any momentum that we might have got from that game had stopped anyway. But then we went into that Liverpool game and we started like a absolute train, and then we're just absolutely awe-inspiring for that first 20-25 minutes in that game, and no one could live with us. And then it's just kind of fallen off the cliff, that the players seem to start getting a little bit confused and not quite sure whether they're playing Potter ball, whether they're playing De Zerbi ball, or is it a combination of two. And how do you see it?
I mean, it hasn't been sweeping changes, has it? It's been bit by bit, which Potter did as well when he first came in. He also looked to play his style with players he'd inherited, and although he said nice things about these players and they did a good job, he did bit by bit bring in or promote or develop or maybe convert the players who he saw for specific jobs. So I suppose that brings us forward to January, and will he be looking to make any changes there? He spoke about changing the roles of McAllister, and it's quite funny actually, because I know McAllister had touched the ball a lot in recent games, and so I asked him about it after the Forest game, and he spoke in detail about it, and we did a piece about, and he's been told to touch the ball 100 to 120 times. So I did a piece about it, and in the press conference last, was it Thursday or Friday morning, the Derby said, I asked him about Caicedo because he'd said that he's trying to change the roles of Caicedo, Gross and Lallana. And I said, how are you trying to change the role of Caicedo? And he said, well, I read in your newspaper a statistic that McAllister is touching the ball 100 times. So it's quite a nice little bit of feedback. And then he said, same with Caicedo. So there are probably more subtle things that we see that are going on. But obviously, he wants to get the ball through, wants McAllister and Caicedo on the ball a lot more, although that wasn't the case, didn't happen at Man City. I think it's a little bit like, as in the pot, and we've spoken on here before about when they play without a handbrake. Our tempo is so key in the Premier League, whatever you're doing. I mean, early in the Potter days, Brighton went to Man City and broke the press and played some really nice football, but it was at such a speed that City could get back and regroup, and you almost had to play through them twice. So I'm not saying, frantic running around, but the way they move the ball and the sort of efficiency of moving the ball, and we saw that in the second half, didn't we, in that move that led to Lamptey getting on the end of a ball and trying to head cross goal. So
it was such a gorgeous move. Okay, well, I mean, yeah. we're coming, jump to City now because we've got other things that we come back to Alexis when, yeah. a little bit later on. But I mean, the Albion were unchanged going into it, and we saw, I mean, we were talking about 70s references before we started recording, but we saw a return to another 70s type. They were man to man marking Brighton.
Yeah, they were quite surprised by it, weren't they? And Bernardo Silva was talking in the mixed zone afterwards about how he felt City were surprised by it, but he also thought they reacted to it by dragging those men away and leaving Haaland with a bit more space. Well, I don't know if we'll come on to the first goal if you want to talk about that, but
yes.
That was an example. That was an example of it. Yeah, but because the first half, I was, De Zerbi was quite pleased with what they did off the ball, but he said on the ball they weren't quite brave enough and they didn't commit players and it wasn't quite what he wanted. And then the second half, I suppose you look at the goal and then that moment that Trossard had at the time watching it, I thought, yeah, he's fair enough in shooting. He's made a great run. But the more you look back, the more you think he should have squared it to Welbeck, and had that gone 2-2, who'd have known? It didn't go quiet around. It's, you know, a lot of grounds, it goes quiet. The home crowd go quiet when they're worried. At City, the home crowd are quiet. They're always quiet. And it gets louder when they're worried. And there was definitely that sound of unease and concern and criticism of their team, actually, for yeah. a little while there, until, obviously, they came up with a brilliant third goal.
It was, I mean, we had 52% possession at the Etihad. And we're the first side to have more possession than City at the Etihad since whom?
Since Brighton, probably.
It was since Brighton. Well done. So, I mean, so us to go there and actually dominate the possession isn't unusual. But at the end of the day, I mean, we've seen that. We saw that against Brentford. We saw it against Forest. You know, you can have the lion's share of possession. It's what you do with it in the final third. And you know, it has been just that cutting edge in the last few games. Now, you mentioned shooting earlier. And it's not something we've been doing from distance an awful lot, to be honest, but Trossard's goal was just a striker.
Can't help feeling the keeper, he must have been unsighted.
Oh, he should have saved it.
I'm sorry, he should have saved it. If it was unsighted, then that's one of those things. But that was a hell of a sort of tiny gap that he got into. I think that this thing about shooting or not shooting, we had this, a lot of this against Forest, and we had it a certain amount against Spurs. Why can't we shoot? Why can't we shoot? The important thing about this is that if, in order for a player to take a shot, he's got to know, and I'm sure they do know this, that is, this was especially the case with Spurs, less so with Forest with their ridiculous anti-football. But with Spurs, if you take a shot and there's no one behind you and the ball rebounds off a defender going ping straight up the pitch and there's no one covering, the likes of Spurs, they just go herring up the pitch and then you're in trouble again. So you've got to make sure that the shot that you have is not going to be blocked. By all means, if it gets a deflection, that's one thing. But if it's blocked and then it runs away to a Spurs player who's ready for the pounce, who's ready for that transition, that's when you're in trouble with a breakaway. And Spurs actually, you know, had that in abundance, and certainly with City, you know, they've got certainly the talent to do that. So you've got to be so careful.
That's largely Spurs' MO this season to sit
well
back.
Exactly, but you've got to be so careful when you're taking that shot that it doesn't rebound. You've got to make sure a player is behind you ready to pick up the pieces. And you know, so I mean, when Spurs, they park the bus, Forest certainly park the bus. So the likes of Man City, when we're playing them, and I suspect it might be the case with Chelsea, yeah, again, you have to be careful, but there's a chance that we're going to be able to take those long-range shots again if we're not closed down properly, due to the fact that Chelsea will give us that little bit more space.
But I don't think Brighton have been short of shots, have they, on the stats? If you look at how many...
I mean,
there are more. They could have had more, true, but I don't think they've been shot as such.
I haven't got the stats from City, but I mean, against Forest, it was 19 shots on goal. Brentford, 21.
Yeah. Well, it's hard to
seven on target in each game.
Forest.
So it's just really, really frustrating. I mean, let's face it. I mean, we went into that game at the Etihad. We knew that City were always going to be the favourites. I mean, let's face it. They're just a little bit good, but yeah. They're also... they also had 12 men, Brian. It was a little bit frustrating. I mean,
did you think, let's put it this way, for the first goal, did you think at the time that that was a push?
I'm so trusting of officials in thinking that they get things right, maybe too much. But where we're sitting in the at City is midway inside the other half. So I've got a really good view of De Bruyne's shot. I was right back there. So you're watching it from behind and you see Webster go. The first thing I thought was, this isn't a problem because Adam Webster's got this covered. And next thing, he's down on the ground. I sort of really didn't have an official an opinion one way or the other. But when you then see it, I mean, that would have been given as a push in any sort of midfield skirmish, whatever. Yeah. I wonder if Webster had done that to Haaland, what happened? I was quite surprised that in Premier League football in this day and age, and there's an angle, there is one angle. Unfortunately, our photographer took one angle where you can see two shoulders sort of touching, but there's an angle from, I think it was where the assistant would have been, more or less, where you can actually see the sort of the arm of Haaland and then the pushing motion.
Yes.
So,
the thing is, there's a video capture of that, and that's the point. I think AD retweeted it earlier. It's a clear push. I mean, the referee said shoulder to shoulder. And you look at the footage and you think, that is an out-and-out lie. And you think...
There might have been angle at some point, but...
If that angle surely must have been ready in there and appropriate for the...
Yeah.
For the... I mean, and VAR, which... we'll come to that properly in a second. But if there was that angle that said, you know, if all the others say shoulder and this one says, actually... there is clear daylight between the two shoulders and it was actually a good shove, you know, they should be calling on it. And like you say, if Haaland had gone through and Webster had done exactly the same, you can bet your bottom dollar, well, there would have been a free kick and possibly yellow bordering on red card.
If Adam had tried to do that to Haaland, he'd have been in the stands. He would have just bounced right off again because the guy's just a unit.
Yeah, I know, but you get my point.
Yeah, it's just like, I mean, Haaland's getting a lot of benefit of the doubt. Because, I mean, he is, like we said last week, he's a generational talent, let's face it. But it's like, you still just can't get away with just literally pushing people. I mean, that's what it was.
But therein lies the point. Yes, he did. He is living proof that they can get away with that. And it is the case. Like, let's put it this way. I mean, every single fan of every club will always have their moaning and their grizzling. And officials, you know, sorry about the Jimmy Hill cliche, it is a difficult job. And it doesn't help when you've got the likes of Jurgen Klopp last week, you know, reacting the way he did, especially at a time when, you know, the grassroots games in Merseyside that weekend were called off because of abuse towards officials. So by all means, have an opinion, and let's not get abusive about it. But by the same token, let's have some egalitarianism when it comes to refereeing. Let's not have these ridiculous blind spots, because they are there, especially when it's a big six versus non-big six. I'd love someone to do the stats. I'm sure it must exist. If it doesn't, fair enough. Okay, and it's all down to perception. And we can stop whining and you just think, yes, these things do balance out. But somewhere down the line, there must be some kind of stat, some kind of look into it to say how the behaviour of the referees for a big six side playing a non-big six side versus, you know, other situations.
I think as well that there was sort of media-wise as well, for some members, the story that people would have been hoping to see was Haaland the beast flattening it out, scoring another goal and continuing his fantastic run. So maybe the less willingness to question how he actually scored the goal. Because
that was very much the narrative, yeah.
Yeah, oh, yeah. It fitted what people were there to see. So had it been somebody else.
He flattened Adam Webster. He absolutely knocked him to the ground. He pushed him. Oh, yeah. It was a clear shove, but it's Haaland. So, you know, hooray for him.
Okay, well, let's talk about the other things here. I mean, it was a tale of two penalties, really. One given, one not given.
Yeah,
one that should have been given and one that shouldn't have been given.
Well, yeah, I mean, the first one, I thought you'd ask about this. I didn't interject when Al was talking about all the decisions going for the top six teams, but when I saw the replay on that, the Haaland one, I didn't actually see on our little monitor. There seems to be a consensus that that should have been a penalty. I must admit, the replay that I saw, I didn't necessarily see contact, or even if players are allowed to sort of touch each other. If they come into contact, it doesn't necessarily, it has to be enough to knock the person over. So I didn't necessarily see, and I probably went on my audio and said he dived. So perhaps I haven't seen a good enough replay, and it was enough of a, there was a contact and enough to send him sprawling.
Yeah. I mean, it so was at a that point, it was a combination actually between Dunk and Sanchez, but I mean, like, Sanchez caught him and so did Dunk. So
didn't you just say that actually if anyone touches Haaland, they end up in the stand?
Well, you know.
Yeah, exactly. You see, so you can't have it both ways.
It depends if you're going to
try
is.
And tackle. If you're going to try and tackle Haaland and you bounce off him and you end up, you know, 20 yeah. yards away, then there's no way the bloke. It's not physically possible to send him.
To be fair to Haaland, I think he is less likely to go down unless he is actually fouled. I don't think he is that.
Mate,
sort of
he plays for Man City. Unlike
Bernardo Silva.
But if you're just talking about going down, just mention Grealish was the dive of the day. We've got a great picture of that one when he went with Veltman. But yeah, the Bernardo Silva one.
Who knew, Brian? Like, who knew?
So that was, but there was at that point from the Haaland one with Sanchez around the ground, there was a sort of a feeling of amongst the City fans that this is an injustice, refs giving us a hard time. Oh no, not again! And like there was an ironic sort of cheer when Caicedo was booked for his foul. But that was mystifying, wasn't it? The penalty that was given, because I'd almost forgotten about it. Like it had gone. It was a hopeful shout. The referee had waved it away. Player continued. Few things had happened. And then all of a sudden, why is he running over to the side of the pitch? That was one of the mystifying things, why it took so long. And I think the more, if you look at something like that, the more you're looking and looking and looking, the more you might think you've seen something. Whereas actually, the first look at it as a skilled official may well be the correct one.
It's the mantra. Plain and obvious, isn't it?
Well, the point is that the consideration is, did the referee miss? What did he miss? I mean, he saw, well, Silva went down. Did he miss something that happened? Or did he, you know, not see something that happened? But then it's the way that they look at the replay. And then in slow motion, yeah, it looks a bit iffy. But then what you've got is Dunk's foot was already there. And Silva went into it rather than, it wasn't Dunk knocking Silva down. If anything, it should have been a foul on Dunk for Silva kicking Dunk, because Dunk's foot was already there.
Yeah.
But when you look at it in slow motion, then yeah, it looks a bit iffy. But when you look at it in real time, you think, well, actually, Dunk was already there. It's Silva that's gone into him.
I just couldn't quite work out. I know you hate the concept of winning a penalty, Al, but it's like...
Oh, well, he's done exactly that.
For a player like it, I mean, basically, you had Gross. He had his hand on his back anyway. You know, I thought he was actually going over because of the push. He wasn't. It's just the dangle of the leg. It's like, as you said a minute ago, Brian, it's like contact is allowed.
Yeah, yeah, and there was not a foul by anybody there, and Bernardo Silva actually stopped in the mix zone afterwards and did a few answered a few questions, and it was all about tactics and various things and Haaland and going to Dortmund and all this stuff. And then somebody said, "You weren't very happy with VAR last week, were you?" In relation to their game at Liverpool, he said, "You a bit happy with it this week?" And there was a few laughs around the reporters and a little bit Silva, in fact. And the most that he said about that decision was some weeks they go for you, some weeks they don't. Or, sorry, the other way around, some weeks they don't go for you and some weeks they do. So I was waiting for him to say, oh, yeah, I was pushed in the back or I was tripped. And he didn't actually say that. He just said, you know, they
were. So basically, what he's effectively done is he's knowledgeably and deliberately gone down with the view of, let's see if I can get this. That's what I'm getting from. You know what you're saying, his response was, I'm going to go down, I'm going to kick Lewis Dunk, then go over, then see what I can get from it. And like I say, initial thing, get on with the game. Then a second look, thinking, and this is a secondary consideration, or the next consideration about VAR. And I don't think it's necessarily whether they go for you or against you, or whether they're right or wrong, which is another matter entirely. Because even then, when you VAR'd it, sometimes the opinion, you'll split opinion. What seems to be the case is the amount by which, if a VAR referee says, I think you should have a look at this, how rare, and it's not never, but how rare it is that they'll turn around and say, actually, disagree with it, happy more on field thing. It's exactly. Almost like they have to be in unison.
It is happening more often, though, to be fair, Al. I mean, you're right. You are right by the fact that when normally if they get sent to the screen, you know what the end result's going to be. But we have actually seen, I mean, Michael Oliver in particular is particularly good at saying, no, I'm going to stick with my original decision.
I'm thinking
how often has he done that? I can only think of one example of that, like, unless I've missed some.
I think it's two or three times.
What's the one you're thinking of, Brian?
A Brentford game. Is it Brentford and Leeds?
I can't recall. I mean, the only one that springs to mind with me is actually, well, the only time with Brighton that springs to mind was up at Spurs a couple of years ago. I mean, to my mind, Solly March did foul the bloke.
Yeah.
The referee, the VAR called it over and said, I think you should have a look at it. And the bloke said, no, I'm happy with it. Now, it equaled up the really dodgy Harry Kane behaviour, but two wrongs don't make a right.
Okay, well, that's a nice little link there, in fact, Al, because the man who scored that goal at Spurs was Tarek Lamptey. And his minutes, Brian, seem to be increasing on the pitch of late. I mean, it's been very stop-start for him, but he actually got a 45 minutes at the weekend. And his presence is certainly growing.
Yeah, he facilitated a bit of a change of shape as well, and a couple of positional changes. Solly March, by the way, how he helps teams play in different shapes and different formations is so valuable. In terms of Lamptey, obviously he was a good outlet, he was a good target, he stretched the play wide. The end product was, I mean, sometimes he seems a bit reticent about actually taking players on when he's got them stood up in front of him. That's why I always thought he was so good running into spaces when Potter played him deep as a wing back rather than, say, as a wider midfield. But he does give that. He's one of those pushing for places. And one of the things with De Zerbi is he's not making many changes. There don't seem to be many players who are doing enough to get into his 11. Well, if any.
But
have
I mean,
Brian, have teams wised up to Lamptey?
Maybe. I mean, he's been out a long time as well. As he was absolutely flying to start with. He was an unknown, bit of an unknown
quantity,
sort of a real handful as well. But I just think he was asked that De Zerbi was asked about Lamptey, and it wasn't like glowing praise. He thought he'd done well, but he still said he wasn't sort of to the level of the starting 11 or the sort of 11 or 12 that he's been using. So I'd be interested to see what part he could play against Chelsea, but he does offer something different.
Yeah, because I mean, going back to what you were saying there as well about him not taking a lot, do you think that maybe that's a mental block? Because obviously that with his hamstring issues, which hopefully are over for him now, but it was that little explosion of pace that took him past the last defender that saw his hamstrings go on a regular basis.
I'm not sure, or maybe it's make sure you keep possession. I mean, he has put a few balls in, hasn't he? Given him a bit of an extra dimension. He put one in for Trossard the other day. I'm not really sure, but he seemed to have more spaces when he was, maybe that goes back to Al's comment. He seemed to find more spaces in his early days, but just interested to see what he can do with De Zerbi, because he, like I say, gave him sort of qualified praise after the game. So, I don't know that he's done enough to start games at the moment, but we'll see.
Okay. And we will see at the weekend, which we'll talk about very shortly. But first, you are listening to the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb, 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB, and of course on our podcast. We are, as ever, brought to you in association with the brilliant oldfootballshirts.com. And Phil has provided us with another shirt for us to peruse for this week. So
good job he only has 125,000 to choose from.
He's got one or two. It's not as nice as last week's, is it?
I really like last week's one. It was Toulon, wasn't it?
Toulon, yeah.
Yeah, and very, very mod. Last week's one looks like the sort of jumper that Paul Weller would have worn when he was in the Jam. Not this time.
What Graham Potter was wearing when, sorry?
Not even Potter wears the proper mod stuff. He's more like a milk tray man. This is very not mod, this shirt.
No, this is more like maybe next in the late 80s or something.
All you need to do is put the collars up. Do you want to describe this then, Brian?
Green and white hoops.
Fair enough.
Back in the days when you like your parents used to buy clothes from like catalogs like Janet Fraser or Littlewoods or whatever. I seem to remember my mum getting me a jumper look very much like this when I was knee high to a leprechaun.
When I was growing up, my mum used to do Pippa D parties. That was a clothing line as well. And I recall that D minor as well. And there was a particular type of vest where it went in at the back on the shoulder blades, but I most associate with Northern Soul vests. Sorry, I was just really sort of going back. I mean, I'm probably one of the last people that should ever be talking about sartorial matters, but I'm just thinking this is one of those things like Tupperware parties and wicker parties that mums used to host back in the 70s. This was one of those. Sorry, Brian, back to the green and white hoops.
Well, the giveaway for some people, though not for me, is possibly that Brooks emblazoned across the front as what looks like a sponsor, although it also appears to be the manufacturer as well, because there's Brooks in small letters at the top. And I don't know if they're long sleeves or short sleeves. They're sort of mid-length sort of sleeves. Green and white hoops. And I'm guessing from a team who don't normally wear green and white hoops.
So who do you think it is? And what year?
Don't know. Well, I mean, it looks sort of 90s, early 90s or late 80s.
I'm going to assume
don't know.
This is an English club, and so I'm going to say Yeovil.
You are incorrect. It is an English club. And Brian, you're right. It is early 90s.
And
it's not Celtic either. And it is an away shirt. You're right. This is your shirt of the week, says Phil. And unusual colours for this one. Not normally associated with Queen's Park Rangers, but indeed, this is the 91 to 92 third shirt of the Super Hoops from West London. QPR play at the 18,439 capacity Loftus Road Stadium, which is now known as the Kayhan Prince Foundation Stadium, in honour of the former QPR youth player Kayhan Prince, who was murdered in a knife attack in 2006. The team was formed in 1882 as Christchurch Rangers, changing the name to Queen's Park Rangers in 1886, when they merged with another local side, St Jude's Institute. Election to the Football League came in 1920, and since then they've been runners-up in the First Division to Liverpool in 1976, won the second-tier division a couple of times, and spent 23 seasons in the top flight of English football, most recently in the 2014 to 2015 season. Notable players include goalie Phil Parks, Stan Bowles, Rodney Marsh, Jerry Francis, and a bit more recently, Les Ferdinand and Trevor Sinclair. Also, one of my early footballing heroes, says the film, Tony Curry, who played over 80 games for the Hoops between 79 and 1982. Links to the Albion. Well, there are loads. Arguably, Tony Curry is one. His nephew, Darren Curry, had an all-too-brief spell with Dean Stadium, making 22 league appearances for Brighton before being lured away to Ipswich Town in the mid-season transfer window. Bobby Zamora and Joel Lynch both had three seasons at QPR, and bang up to date is midfielder Taylor Richards, who is on a season-long loan at the West London club. My all-time favourite Albion player, John Byrne, had four seasons at Loftus Road, making 126 league appearances, scoring 30 times before he ventured overseas to Le Havre. And then also John Gregory left the Albion to join QPR in 81 at the same time that Don Shanks joined us from QPR. But one link which isn't a football playing link is, of course, a lad called Anthony. He joined the Albion from Brentford in 1999 and went on to make 224 appearances for Brighton. His full name is Anthony Phillip, David, Terry, Frank, Donald, Stanley, Gerald, Jerry, Gordon, Stephen, James, Otway. His father, a huge QPR fan, of course, everyone knows this story, named him after the 1973 QPR first team squad. His aunt said he'd look a right proper Charlie with that name, and thus the name Charlie stuck. So there you go. Thank you for that. Of course, you can see that shirt and over 120,000 more over oldfootballshirts.com, including that beautiful one from Toulon from last week.
That was one of my first footballing memories, was QPR so close to winning the old First Division. In those days, they didn't actually finish the season, as they correctly do now, finish the season all at the same time. And I think that QPR needed to beat Norwich to secure the title. And you look back on it and you think, QPR, who were they? But hang on, you think, well, Derby County won the league twice in the 70s. Forest, Nottingham Forest won the league in the 1970s. Even Leeds United, remember them? Yeah. They won the league, although they were one of the better sides. But QPR, so close to winning it.
Yeah.
And they end up losing that game 3-2. By the time their season was finished, Liverpool played Wolves. They managed to get their win, and Liverpool won the title for their first time in about 3 years. But that QPR side, if you get to see any old footage of them on Match of the Day or Big Match, I mean, I assume you remember them, Brian.
Yeah, I was just about. I do remember that night, that the game where Liverpool won at Molineux, and they were behind for a long time, weren't they? I remember listening to it on Radio 2. Probably Peter Jones and Brian Butler.
Yeah.
And I think didn't QPR win their last match at home? Sorry, way off topic here. And they sort of went up and got the cheers of the crowd who all came onto the pitch, and they celebrated as much as they could. They'd done their job, but then they went away. And I'm sure I remember reading in Shoot a couple of weeks later how Jerry Francis went to watch the Wolves game in a TV studio, and as soon as Liverpool equalised, he went home, so he knew it was all over.
Sure.
And he wasn't following it on Twitter on the way home either. So
no.
That was probably my first season I can remember, but not one I expected to be talking about this evening.
No, but like I say, I mean, as Andy points out, there's a hell of a lot of linkage between, and there's probably a lot more still.
Yeah, we think of Ipswich as well. You know, they were one of those like QPR, any more so.
I was about to say, I mean, that team under Bobby Robson was just absolutely, it was delightful. And they obviously went on to win the UEFA Cup as well.
Between 73 and 82, there was only one season where they finished below third. Do you know which one that was? 78, that's when they won the Cup.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Right. There you go. Okay, well, hopefully we'll win the Cup.
What are we talking about next then?
Let's talk about Derby County winning the league then, shall we?
No, let's not. Okay.
Top of the league.
Okay, so I mean the festive fixtures have been announced today.
Silly carry on.
It's not great, really. I mean,
far off being as bad as Boxing Day last year. New Year's Eve. We've got at least the good grace of the games are suitably spaced apart, rather than 2 days apart, which is our normal stunt they pull. But New Year's Eve at 5:30, okay, that means we're out there at 7:30. Anyone that's got a Moriarty sorted out that evening, forget it, because you're not getting home back to Brighton before 8:30. It's once again. I mean, at least we have the vague notion of having public transport to helping us getting back. That's fine. I mean, at least it runs on New Year's Eve to a certain extent. Boxing Day was utterly, utterly ludicrous. I mean, they might as well just put a calendar up on the front of a dartboard and sling a dart in it and see what happens, because 5:30 on New Year's Eve is ludicrous.
I'm quite intrigued that that's seen as a time when people will be watching. Because obviously these things people say, don't the TV companies take any notice of fans travelling? Of course not. They take notice of when armchair fans will most likely want to watch the game. And I don't know, 5:30 till 7:30 on New Year's Eve. It's quite interesting that that's seen as a good time to be showing matches. I remember once at one of our press conferences, one of the Sky people was talking about which slots are most popular. And obviously Liverpool, Man City is always popular whenever you put it on. But as a rule, it was that 5:30 Saturday slot, when people had just got in and before they went out again, was the most, was tended to get the best figures. So maybe that's what they're looking at. But New Year's Eve. So I can see why they might want it for TV, but for practicalities of getting there and then going afterwards.
This all started, I mean, a few years ago. I mean, they did actually get moved to the end, I think, but it was Liverpool were due to be playing Arsenal on Christmas Eve, I think it was.
Right.
And they made that an 8:00 kickoff on Christmas Eve. And like, good luck, Liverpool fans, getting back for Christmas Day.
It isn't as bad as Boxing Day at 8:00. I mean, at least they've got the good grace of not doing this at New Year's Eve at 8:00. In which case, even I would have to consider not going, because you think this is absolutely ludicrous. This is just stupid. I nowadays live in Goring-by-Sea. I'm from Brighton, but I now live in Goring-by-Sea. And the trains out here are fairly regular, but not absolutely superb. So the chances of me getting in, assuming I go to the game, me getting in before 8:30 are virtually zero. I've got to, you know, consider what we're doing with my, you know, me and my partner. And, I won't be alone in that consideration. And I can see another one of those games where the attendance might be officially 30,000, but you know full well that there's about 12,000 empty seats.
I can see that as well. I mean, you've obviously got to think about the Arsenal fans as well. I mean, you're talking about, oh, we're not going to get Mike at home until later. They've got to then have to get back to London. And
some do. Not everyone, remember. I mean, don't forget, you jump on the train at Worthing Station, mate. How many Gooners shirts are there?
All right. Point taken. I always try to ignore that. And then, funnily enough.
Will Arsenal be more of a motivation to get to a game than Brentford were as well? I don't know.
There's that. In terms
of how many people actually go to the match. But it's just like you say. I mean, I look at it from a perspective of that is my work. So what are we doing on that day? Well, I'm doing that, and then everything gets built around it. But I can see if it's a social thing, if it's part of your social life, and it's not, you know, it could be very hard to make that case of, well, no, actually, I'm off to football now, you know.
Yeah.
So there is going to be conflicts of
who to nanny if he's not, is what I'm going to say. I mean, you know, I might have to retire my silvery, glittery wig for the evening. And it's...
Well, for those that do go, I can't help feeling that Brett's place would be pretty packed.
I'd imagine so. Also, the Everton game's been moved as well.
That's all good as well, isn't it?
It was on a bank holiday. It was at 3 o'clock.
I think the third is a bank holiday. Let's put it that way. I haven't checked.
I believe it will be.
Okay, but let me just So but even then, well, whether it is or it isn't, let's put it this way: the important thing is the next day isn't.
The next day, yeah.
Actually, I'm looking at this. It's actually a bank holiday in Scotland.
Oh,
the 3rd of January.
Oh,
so to be honest, it didn't really matter one way or the other. It would have been, you know, so it would have been if the game was on the Monday, the 2nd of January, you still had the same problem of being a bank holiday the next day.
Was it? I think it was originally, wasn't it?
It was the 2nd. It was literally just the 2nd. But obviously, that's quite a tight turnaround from playing. That's the other thing, is how many days you need between the games. You know, you could have it on the 2nd, but then we'd be complaining that Brighton have got a game on the 31st and the 2nd. They need more space.
Yes.
Well, they won't have played for a few weeks.
you don't get a game for 6 weeks and then three turn up in 5 minutes.
Which brings us nicely on to the
World Cup contenders from South America. World Cup contenders from South America.
World Cup contenders from South America. Actually, I think Argentina have got a very good chance.
Yeah. Also to Ecuador.
And we're going all the way. But let's talk about our Argentinian number 10, who's pledged his future to the Albion today. And I'm absolutely delighted, Brian. I mean, I think he's probably been my player of the season so far.
Yeah, and he just loves getting on the ball, doesn't he? He's adapted his game. Something that Graham Potter saw initially, I guess, and started him in that sort of engine room role. And where he fits is that he likes getting the ball with players tight on his back, close to him, under pressure, and he'll keep it and play the right pass. And a lot of it is sort of quite unspectacular. You might not notice at the time. Obviously, he plays those sort of balls out wide as well, which are sort of quite eye-catching. We haven't seen so much of him shooting. I hadn't thought under De Zerbi, but then looking at the stats, he has had a few shots, which I don't necessarily remember all of them. But yeah, fantastic story when you think how he came here and he came in the middle of all those storms and then he couldn't get out because of lockdown and it was difficult to get to him. Had to wait for his chance. It's a really nice story. Sort of touched on earlier, actually.
I mean, he made his debut on the game away at Wolves, which was the last game before lockdown.
Right, because I mean, I think he probably had a four-year contract, about the first 18 months of which he was on loan back in Argentina, wasn't he?
Yeah.
So, you know, and even then, once he's here, he still takes his time. And I think that you can see the growth in his quality. You know, at first he played, you know, you could see it almost, I wouldn't say it overawed him, but you could see that there was a culture clash here, that the game was a lot quicker. I mean, probably nothing like as dirty. but it was a lot quicker. The movement, the thoughts, the consideration had to be quick. And you can see that in those intervening months and years, he's got that bit quicker. He's got that bit more accurate. He's got that bit more feisty. And, you know, just once in a while, he can pick out a shot.
No, I don't completely agree with that. I think that he was pretty quick anyway. I mean, if you look at his first proper goal involvement for Brighton, which was Neil Maupay's winner against Arsenal in the first game back after of the lockdown. I mean, he was just so instrumental in that goal, and his speed of thought and quickness of passing was just delightful, Brian.
I think you could hear him shout, couldn't you, from in the stand?
Yeah, you could.
And get the ball in play. I thought a couple of things where he's really progressed. One is his physicality. He's worked hard. He's stronger. He's occasional contact with his brother, who also plays in top flight in Argentina. And he said he hardly recognises the way he plays and his sort of physique. He's got a lot stronger.
Oh, really?
And his English is fantastic now, and it was almost non-existent when I remember first talking to him. So that is another, it's nothing to do with the football, but it's going to make life easier as well, and the adaptation easier. And I think him and his partner have sort of worked hard to really get settled in England when it wasn't the easiest circumstances. And I think it was quite difficult for him as well. I've read interviews, not necessarily with me, but also in Argentina, about settling in. It wasn't, it was quite a tough process, and they're very young as well. Now feeling really at home.
So when you're doing interviews with him now, Brian, are you doing them in English now, or are you still doing it in Spanish with him?
Funnily enough, when he came over the other night, he started speaking to me in Spanish, and because there was two other reporters there, I said, look, we do it in English because we're doing it all together. And he said, fine. So he wanted to do it in Spanish, but he's fine in English. He's really good. So we don't need to. One thing that I can do if I speak to a player in Spanish is also use the audio to sort of South Americans can hear it as well, which go down quite well, particularly with Caicedo, who's such like a national hero in Ecuador.
So we
can put those on our website or our social media outlets. But no, he, as you've heard, he he's really good in English, but he did initially start speaking Spanish. That was, you know, at the end of a long night, getting on for 11 o'clock last Tuesday night, and a long, disappointing night, that he made the effort. And he spoke really well and gave us that insight into his, you know, his target of 120 touches per game.
has he taken to the Iron Brew yet?
Mata, it's the Mata, isn't it?
That's
always got with him, which he's always carrying around with him. Even when we went to that, you know, the friendly against Brentford behind closed doors.
Yeah,
some of the first teamers came to watch, and he had his little mate making kit there. So he's always got that with him. Like Johnny Cantor had a little go with
he
it.
He did have it. He hated it.
Yeah.
What is it?
It's kind of like, it's like a herbal tea. It's like, it's very, very popular in South America. It's something that they've all the South Americans just go absolutely crazy for it. I mean, I believe they sell it in Latino America, so it's like
right. I mean, is it?
I think I stick to the Malbec when I go there.
It's like a social thing as well, isn't it? But imagine us English people carrying a teapot around with them in a little bag or something. That's almost what it is. Yeah. But when
your bag of Tetley, PG tips.
But he's a really good talker, Alexis. You know?
Say again, Brian.
He's a really good talker. Like I say, he didn't need to give that amount of detail and that sort of insight into what he's been asked to do and what his reaction was. But you know, nearly 11 o'clock last Tuesday night, so he's a really good talker. His English is really impressive. So really very pleased for him, and maybe a good sign of what he thinks is happening at Brighton as well.
I assume he's going to Qatar, isn't he?
I think he's done enough. Yeah, I think he certainly will.
I mean, we're going to have a few people over there. And it's going to be, I mean, gives us a vested interest in it. I mean, it's a tournament which shouldn't be happening, as we all know.
Not in the form that it's going ahead. There should be a World Cup, of course there should, but not in the form that it's going in. But yes, I mean, we're going to have, obviously we'll have McAllister. We've got, are we going to get the Ecuadorian trio? Are they going? Are all three going?
Yeah, I would have thought so.
Assuming fitness.
Yeah. Lamptey, I guess, with Garner.
Sure.
Obviously, Trossard, Mitoma. The Japanese journalists are asking questions after every game. Will he be ready for the World Cup? And I think Serbi's not really looking at it in that context. No. He's looking at it, will he be fit for Chelsea? But they are the Japanese reporters who follow, because there are a couple who follow around, even when Matar's not playing. There was one up at Man City, for example, on Saturday. There's a reporter from Gazzetta dello Sport who's following Brighton around at the moment. But yeah, sorry, Mitoma, they're worried about his injury. But yes, Sanchez, you'd think, might be coming under a little bit of pressure thanks to Ben Roberts' efforts with
He has turned him into a world beater all of a sudden, hasn't he? It's like I was mentioning this to someone the other day. It's just crazy, really.
But it's also actually kind of confirming what we've been saying on the show for quite a while, and I know that Brian have been saying it, and it kind of had gone under the radar as just what a good goalkeeping coach Ben Roberts actually is.
Yeah, I think people acknowledge it. I don't know how under the radar. I know what you mean. He deserves the credit. But I think, you know, for example, David Stockdale used to mention every time he saved a penalty, thanks to Ben Roberts. So I think he has had his praise and he has had his credit. And talking to somebody who covers the Spanish national team for one of the sports papers there, he thinks that they will stick with the three goalkeepers. You know, it's not like Sanchez has done anything wrong. It's just that Kepa is in form as well. But sometimes good players miss out, Al.
Yeah. Well, yes. I mean, they were saying it was an audition of sorts at Brentford the other night with David Raya. And the Spanish coach was watching on, apparently. So,
But one notable absentee from the World Cup, and given that his manager hasn't picked him once since he actually took over, Louis van Gaal hasn't picked Joel Veltman at all. Now, if Veltman's to continue his international career, then the Dutch need to change their coach, because Veltman is not going to be going to Qatar, is he?
No, it doesn't sound like it. It sounds like he's going to go on holiday with his family.
Yes.
There's always seagulls that need rescuing, Ryan. Always seagulls that need rescuing.
But what's Netherlands' loss, I think, is Brighton's gain. I mean, because as much as as you say, Adi, we have vested interests in this tournament, and you want to see our players doing well. You also don't want them to come back completely broken. And this is an almighty time, given that, obviously, with one of our better players not going, this is, like I say, we've got I'm sure the club can see this anyway. I'm not telling anyone they don't know, but this is effectively a close season, and De Zerbi is going to have the vast majority of the players at his beck and call while the World Cup is on, while the players are training, to actually really put down his ideas and for the players to really get hold of them. And I wouldn't mind betting that, as much as we're struggling a little bit, marking time, not scoring goals we should do. I'm going to make a sort of relatively confident prediction that when it comes to, the first game on Boxing Day and going forward from there, and with the players having spent as much time on the training ground doing what De Zerbi wants them to do, that we will actually see a new Albion side or a new approach to the game that, finally puts De Zerbi's stamp on it. Because at the moment, he's not in a position to make wholesale changes, whereas this World Cup would have given the opportunities to do that. Do you see that happening at all, Brian?
Yeah, and I think we were talking about it, one or two of us, after the game at Man City, just as the sort of dust had settled and the players had left and it was all quieting down, and just that sort of, it'll come right. It's they're not far away, and how big that could be, that break. And but then players will be aware of the World Cup. But how long will they actually be away for, some of them? Perhaps some of them might not be away for all that long. McAllister might be away for quite a while, actually.
Sanchez might, Trossard might. But
yeah, I don't know how it works with the draw, sure. But
I mean, with this idea, I mean, Southgate's coming out with this notion that he's going to name an initial squad of 52 or something.
Doesn't he have to do that? Don't they have to do that? Isn't it a requirement for all the countries?
I'd be amazed if he's got a name 52 and he still doesn't include any Brighton players, then that is a glaring omission.
I might be wrong here, though, but isn't it a requirement for all the nations? And also, it's not published, so we would not know who is in it. Some sort of admin thing. Sorry, if I'd have...
I would say that Dan Burn's got a good chance of going at the moment. But...
he might have a chance of being in that big, big squad, but seeing as he's never played for England or been in the squad, let's put it this way. When you get to this close to a World Cup, what you don't do is put in a rookie like that. Even you might put in someone who's not had a game, but you don't put in someone who's never been in the squad.
Yeah. Needs to get Ben White in first.
Sorry, Brian?
Needs to get Ben White in first before he starts thinking about...
Well, exactly. Exactly. I mean, the fact we're hearing about Dan White is because Newcastle fans like to make a racket. You know, I haven't seen a massive marked improvement of Dan Burn's qualities. You know what he brought to the Albion side. You can see what he brings to the Newcastle side. He's not suddenly become a world beater. It's just that he's actually a vast improvement on behalf of Newcastle fans on what they had before. And therefore, he's going to be England quality. And it actually doesn't work that way.
Okay, I mean, right. Okay, so Chelsea visiting, Bruno returning, Ben Roberts returning, Billy.
Yeah.
And Bjorn returning, Anna
and Frieda are staying back behind, but we've also got Crystal Tips coming back as well. What's your view on this as to how it's going? Is it going to be sort of the return of the prodigal son, or is it a smattering of Judas?
I fear there will be some bitterness, and I think we sort of spoke about it quite a bit at the start, didn't we? I think the fact Brighton aren't flying perhaps won't help that. I hope it could be one of the great Amex occasions. Yeah. Potter knows quite a lot about the Brighton team, of course, but that might help Brighton surprise him a little bit. It could go one of two ways, couldn't it? I'm sort of looking forward to it. I'm not around at work this week. It would have been quite a good one to preview. I'm not sure this is before the Salzburg game. I'm not sure they've been absolutely in top form recently. They haven't exactly been firing loads of shots and.
They're flattering to deceive a little bit, but I mean, like we knew what would happen with Graham Potter. He's not going to go. He's not an instant fix manager. He's going to go there, and it will take a while for his processes to come to fruition.
You should see some of the howling from Chelsea fans on Twitter when they said, "Well, Mason Mount's here, and Sterling's there, and so and so's here." And you think, "Well, actually, shut up a minute, learn something, and you might actually." And what happens is that these players are getting better. Well, and
my thing here, though, Al, is that obviously the players will want to prove a point as well. And I think, obviously, you said that Graham Potter knows all the players. Well, the players all know Graham Potter as well. So it's Graham Potter, he would have studied the Zerbi. He'll have an idea. But I mean, I can see a spring and a surprise, and I think we're going to come out all guns blazing. And I will not be surprised if we actually finally...
It's about time we've beat them, isn't it? Back.
Well, never beaten them. De Zerbi hasn't had a win. Potter hasn't had a defeat. Welbeck hasn't scored this season. There's so many stories waiting to be written, isn't there? We'll see. We'll see.
Perhaps he'll play again, Brian.
Sorry, Brian. I thought you wrote the stories, not created them.
Potter hasn't missed a Brighton goal at the Amex yet, so perhaps you'll see the next one.
And with that, that's all we've got time for. So thank you, of course, to Brian Owen. Thank you to Alan Wares. I've been AD Packham. This has been the Albion Raw on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB, and of course on a podcast and in association with oldfootballshirts.com. Thanks for listening. Let's hope we celebrate next week. See you then. Bye.